If the river keep rising, water gonna overflow.
All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Randall, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blues Chip Speakers Meeting at NABA. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety. Tell his or her story. This reading is based on the passages from page 29 of the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and our personal story is described in their own language and from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut ideas of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listen later on aabluechipspeakers.org desperately in need. Well, our speaker, and we believe that is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems, that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Now I will introduce the speaker. Tonight's speaker is Monsignor Stephen C.
My name's Stephen, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety dates, January 17th, 2004. For those that don't want to do the math, it's 19 years, be 20 if I make it to January. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I grew up, normal childhood, grew up not far from here, went to Lakeside High School around the corner, had a loving family, no real alcoholism tendencies or wild parties or anything to really, you know, make you think, oh yeah, well, you know, that's what happened. Grew up with my grandparents 2 blocks from me, so they pretty much raised us. Me and my younger brother, he's a year younger than me, so we're pretty close. Have an older brother, 5 years older, but we grew up with my grandparents, you know, teaching us right and wrong. Both my parents worked. They would more or less babysit us through elementary school, and by high school we were allowed to stay at home. Everything was good growing up, loving, nurturing home, you know, nothing to trigger, quote, my rebellious bad behavior. But, you know, I grew up on some really great movies of the era, you know, shit like Dukes of Hazzard, Smokey and the Bandit. You know, who the hell doesn't want to live that life? And, unfortunately, I've lived most of that life, for good, bad, or indifferent. Oh, speaking of which, I better put my disclaimer in. My wife and my mother-in-law have not heard my story. So I just want to put it out there that we got married for better or for worse. So whatever gets divulged here, you're still married to me. I was supposed to leave with that. But anyway, back to the topic. Anyway, grew up, you know, great childhood, doing great in elementary school, popular, cool, hip, slick, whatever. Good grades, doing great. And got to high school, and at the time, you know, elementary school here was 1 through 7, high school 8 through 12. And elementary school, when I graduated, we went off to high school. Well, 98.5% of the school went to Henderson High School, and then there was about 5 or 6 of us went to Lakeside. And the 5 or 6 of us that went to Lakeside, it was me. And then there was a bunch of other people that went to school there. They were not in the same social clique or whatever that I was. So I got thrown under the bus. I like to refer to it as going from a hero to a zero over summer break. Getting to high school, don't know anybody. I'm not a social person. I am a shy, timid, scared individual. People laugh about that today, but that's who I am. As a kid, I remember God knows how many times my grandmother pushing me to order something at McDonald's, and I wouldn't even talk to the cashier because I was petrified of talking to people. High school was not fun. Grew, you know, kept going. Met a couple of friends. You know, we were all, quote, rebels without a clue, so to speak. We were We were up to no good, wanting to have fun, be a badass, you know, whatever. When I was 13, I joined a youth group. I excelled there, leader of that group. Matter of fact, I got some state recognition on that level. But when I was 14, my grandmother had a stroke. Now, I say that because I grew up with my grandmother and my grandfather. You know, they were just as much a mom and dad to me as my own parents were. We wound up having to put her in a nursing home. She had another stroke and another stroke and another stroke. You know, all within, I don't know, probably 2 weeks of one another. For a long time, you know, we took care of her at home. I remember Granddad keeping her at home as long as we could. And me and my younger brother and my mom, we'd all take turns, shifts, you know, just being there with her and whatnot. But she had another stroke. We had to put her in a nursing home. And I remember I went to see her when I was 15. The little old lady that I saw in that bed was not my grandmother. And she deteriorated that much that, I mean, she was, quote, I don't know, 3 foot nothing. But it was a sad sight to see. And at 15, me being as smart as I was, I said a prayer that God go ahead and take her out of her misery. And, you know, there's no need for her to suffer that way. Well, you know, God will answer prayers. You know, she passed away 2 days later. So that was a rough pill to swallow for me at 15. Since then, I've been able to comprehend a few things. My sponsor pointed out a few things, but that went with me for a long time. Well, you know, us being teenage punks without a clue, you know, we were into drinking, smoking cigarettes, looking cool, you know, the whole nine yards. Got drunk once or twice, you know, cool, great. You know, we've arrived, you know, we're badasses. I remember very distinctly me and my best friend that he was my drinking buddy all the way up to the end of me getting sober. But I remember me and him talking when we were teenagers, saying, man, I can't wait till we get to a point where we drink a whole six-pack and not, like, pass out from it. And we had that same conversation, you know, 30 years later, saying, man, don't you wish we could go back to that day where we could split a six-pack of Tall Boys and be just as fucked up? Meanwhile, you know, we got a case of beer sitting next to us just to wet our whistle. But, you know, the irony of all that. It was a tough thing dealing with losing my grandmother. And that was the first time that I realized that alcohol would take away my pain and my feelings. Went home after, you know, I wound up going to funeral home with my grandfather making arrangements. Was very close to my grandfather. I was his namesake. He lived two blocks from us. He taught me how to work, taught me how to, you know, pretty much do any and everything. My dad was more of a wannabe white collar guy. He never really made it, but, you know, he always wanted the image that, you know, he was a great success and didn't like dirt on them and things of that nature. But my grandfather, you know, he was from a different era that you work, nothing you couldn't have if you worked hard enough. So anyway, I go with him. We make the arrangements at the funeral home. Come home, go out back, get on my dirt bike. We got beer hidden in the woods. Start drinking, giving the bike hell, damn killing myself, you know, crashing it and whatever and getting drunker as I go. And I realized alcohol was the answer to problems. You know, this numbs that shit out, man. This is cool. On through high school, I found out the secret solution to getting over all my fears and all my inadequacies and just drink. You know, that's the answer to my problems. And I did that. I laugh about it because drugs aren't really part of my story. I tried this and that, but it was never part of my story because I couldn't drive while on drugs. Now, people laugh about that. You know, granted, I probably shouldn't have been driving while drinking, but, you know, I had the false illusion that, hey, I'm in control, man. Look at this shit. I can do this. But drugs, you know, it was like, oh, wow, man, there's no way I can drive a car like this. But anyway, I always stuck to drinking and got through high school, had quite a few problems getting through high school. Things just weren't that important. I was very academic when I had to be. In other words, I could sit in a classroom, I could sleep during the whole English class, but yet they'd wake me up, give me the test, I'd take the test, make a B on it, and, you know, I could read something, recite it, and, you know, I'd understand it. So, you know, it was just a lack of me wanting to. Got through high school, went on, graduated on time, believe it or not. I got kicked out of Lakeside, had to go to Oakland campus if anybody's from around here. Y'all kind of know what kind of story that puts me in. Anyway, open campus was really cool. That's where all the partiers were, you know, shit. We got a lot of shit in common out there. But anyway, graduate high school on time, go on to technical school. I did not go to college. I knew I had no business going to college because I'd seen this movie called Animal House. And I would have been D-Day. I'd have been riding a Harley up the staircase. You know, there's no two ways about it. So I knew not to go to college would be a waste of money, waste of effort. You know, so I went to technical school, learned automotive, took a two-year program with Ford, went to work, 18 years old, 1988, making $18.50 an hour commission, which that was a lot of money back then. As 18-year-old punk getting a $1,000 paycheck, my God, I have arrived in life. Look at me. It was funny because I managed to be able to drink most of that money up. Time went on. I got married, had a stepson, pretty much raised him from the time he was, I don't know, probably 13 months old. Perfect, perfect picture of the hate between a stepfather. And, you know, I'm just the bad guy, period. Knew I'd never have children of my own. Just knew it, because after going through that shit, why in the hell would I want kids? One day, me and my best friend, we're sitting on somebody's porch, drinking, just watching the day go by, you know, like we so often did. And we were talking about kids, this and that. And he said, well, you know, if you and her had a kid, it's not necessarily going to be pain in the ass and all screwed up, you know, like your life is today with a stepson. I said, you know, I never really thought about that. So me and my wife had a discussion. We decided we'd have kids. Blessed with a beautiful little daughter. I wish I could say she's still a beautiful little daughter. Now she's a young adult that's a pain in the ass, but thrives on drama, things of that nature. But later on, had a son. Redhead, he's a carbon copy of me. People that have met him and talked to him say he's Stephen King 2.0. You know, he's a little bit younger, not quite as handsome, but he's definitely his father's son. I came into the program January 17, 2004. After getting out of school, working jobs, whatever, I'd become successful in my family business with waterproofing basements. Bought a house when I was 23 with my wife. We wound up having children in 90, hell, I don't know what number year it was, 97, I think, was the year my daughter was born. Had a family, had a nice house, cars. I had arrived, you know, life was good. I had everything of the American dream, you know, white picket fence, all shit to go with it. But I was miserable. Completely miserable. Did not know who I was, what I was. Drank excessively. And, you know, and I laugh about it because I talk about it. You know, in my teens, I drank because that's what, you know, rebellious teenagers do. In my 20s, I drank because I didn't go to college to the frat house, so I was drinking over here on the technical school program. In my 30s, I was drinking because I had succeeded at life. You know, I have everything, the American dream, so I've earned this. I deserve this. I remember it very distinctly on the TV show Dallas. They would come in from work. First thing they do, you know, as soon as you walk in the foyer, there was the liquor. They'd open it, pour a drink, and start drinking. You know, that's what you do. Shit, they're successful. Yeah, you know, I'm right there with them. So, you know, I'm drinking all the time, and it's to a point that me and my cousin working with family business waterproofing, we're drinking at work. We're staying out till damn 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Come in, brush your teeth, get in the work truck, go to work. You know, shit. I damn don't feel so good. So we start drinking, you know, in the morning. No big deal, you know. I've always excelled at working, you know, wherever it is, whatever craft it may be, field, you know, that I'm in, I can get a job done. I can drink and get a job done. I had one boss that I worked with in the automotive world. We drag raced a lot, and we had a transmission shop. I'd open it, get everything going, whatever. But every morning I'd come in with a couple of energy drinks, pack of goodies, open the shop up, you know, have a pack of cigarettes, get started. And there was one time I come in, and I warned him my brother was coming in town, so I'd be out late that night. And I probably might not make it to work. Well, I showed up to work anyway, and I looked a little rough around the edges, I guess, because his suggestion was that I go back to the refrigerator and get me a beer, knock the edge off, because I looked like hell. That's what I did. Went on work the rest of the day, whatever, but missed out on some opportunities. Like I say, he was big in drag racing, and I had multiple occasions to race cars. And to somebody that works on cars and, you know, somewhat of a hot rodder or motorhead, that's a pretty cool dream to have. Well, the reality was for me was he asked me to drive one of the cars one day. We were in a bind, and I was like, Jerry, I've been drinking. I can't run the car. Rules won't allow. He said, look, all you got to do is get in, go fast down, just hold it straight. That's all you got to do. I said, all right. So I run one car one time. Hey, and it was thrilling, don't get me wrong. But he's like, man, you did really great, man. You need to start running these cars on the weekends. I said, well, that means I can't drink if I'm driving the car, right? He's like, yeah. I said, I'll stick the fuel in your car and keep the mechanics working on your car. He said, no, I'm not even remotely interested. And I missed out on opportunities like that. You know, I could probably go down a laundry list of them, things that, Nah, I'd rather drink. You know, the hell with that. Up to the point of having the American dream, everything's great. Life sucks. I'm at a point that I love my kids, love my wife, but damn, life just, I couldn't put my finger on it. Something was wrong, something was empty, something was hollow. And I had no idea who I was or what I was. And I knew drinking played a big factor in my life. And I decided it was time for some changes, so I asked my wife for a divorce, knowing that I could not get sober, because that was my plan, was to get sober, get rid of her, and maybe I could figure out what the hell was going on with me. And I had to get rid of her because she is a great enabler. Unfortunately, you know, the joke always was, oh, man, well, you got to drink. Me and my best friend, he lived, you know, 10 miles from me. What do you got left to drink? All we got left, you know, my wife's wine. Shit. You know, we drink anything. But, you know, wine was like, oh, my God, you got to have standards in alcoholism. But we drink her wine, and then it's like, well, shit, I guess we'll have to make that call. So we called my wife, asked her, please go get the case of beer out of the refrigerator in the hot rod shop and bring it to us. So now you got to listen to all this nagging that goes with getting a case of beer from somebody that doesn't want to drive 12 miles. And, you know, you ever want to ruin a party, call somebody that's not alcoholic to bring you more beer in an alcoholic stupor. And she always bring it to us, you know, always get us where we had to be, whatever. And, you know, I feel horrible for the life she was living, but, you know, that was on my amends list. So I got to deal with that, too, but, I decided I was going to get sober, so I asked for a divorce, moved out, wound up back at my mom and dad's, wound up back at my old watering hole, and in short order, I went off the deep end. Before I got to that point, I remembered multiple times standing in my driveway at my house, looking up to God, daring Him to pour more and put more on my shoulders, or you're not going to break me, motherfucker. Lo and behold, he broke me. When I wound up back at my mom and dad's in the old watering hole, there were several instances that I prayed to God, you know, I can't do this anymore. I can't do it. But yet I would get in the truck, and I'd go to that damn bar, and I would drink the night away, and I'd wake up the next day wondering, was I welcome back there? What the hell I'd do? I'd have to dig through my wallet, piece my night together, you know, where I wound up going, how much I spent, what happened. in 3 days, I remember it distinctly, my last drinking. One night I woke up in the following morning in my truck in front of the bar. Second night, I wound up sitting in the driver's seat, truck running, in gear, passed out. Third night, there was a bottle of damn Grey Marnier sitting on the hood of the truck, a 12-pack on the passenger seat, truck running, in gear, and me laying on the street next to it. And I woke up, you know, 4:35 o'clock in the morning. Now, how the hell I didn't get locked up or somebody didn't come, something is beyond me. I know why it happened the way it did today. I did not understand it then. So that was the final fatal point that I said, you know, I've got to do something. So I called the soon-to-be ex-wife to find out about her insurance through her work. And went and checked myself in at Summit Ridge up in Gwinnett. Within, I don't know, 2.5 hours of being there, I got kicked out of there. Didn't work out well. So I called, who did I call? Peaceford. Told me they couldn't help me. So I was like, what the hell you mean you can't help me? They said, well, you know, you checked yourself in a treatment center. You check yourself out. There's nothing we can do, blah, 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 blah. I said, there's absolutely nothing you can do to help me. I got a serious problem here. I need some help. Well, sir, there's nothing we can do. I said, there's absolutely nothing. They said, well, you know, have you had a drink since then? I said, no. They said, well, then there's nothing we can do. I said, ah. What were you going to say if I had had a drink? And they're like, well, you don't want to do that, sir. I said, what was the answer if I had taking a drink? Well, then we could check you in and we have to detox you, blah, blah. I said, okay, I'll see you in a couple hours. So I went, my younger brother asked him, would he give me a ride over to Peachford? He said, yeah, what the hell's going on? I explained to him, you know, my drinking's a little out of hand. I need some help. He's like, well, are you sure? I said, just give me a ride to the nut house. So, drank quite a bit. Went to Peaceford, checked in. I'll never forget it. I left out the part where I went to the Marine Corps because, you know, being a badass, you got to fulfill certain elements. And went to the Marine Corps. Was there for a little while. That didn't work out either. Do not detox in the United States Marine Corps. That's not a good place to do it. I didn't know I was detoxing at the time. I really didn't. I thought I was just going to boot camp. I was going to, you know, do 13 weeks and go to A school. You know, all this was going to work out great. Looking back on it, I was detoxing from cigarettes and alcoholism. So that was not a good place to be with some sawed-off staff sergeant, drill instructor, staff sergeant Pluchinski. I'll never get his fucking name. Damn Barkin. And he's a little small in stature, so he had two guys stacked foot lockers so he could stand down on me and spit on me while he spoke, but that didn't work out either. Anyway, back to that. I got January 17th, I walked into the Gwinnett room, or I crawled in there, however you want to phrase it. I knew I needed to quit drinking. I knew I needed to be at these A&A meetings. And I also knew that those 12 steps on that damn wall don't have a damn thing to do with how not to drink. I sat in the rooms. An old man welcomed me that first night, asked me what my name was. After the meeting, he said, well, son, don't drink tonight and come back tomorrow. Just get through the night without drinking. Come back tomorrow. Came back the next day. He knew my name. Hey, Stephen, how you doing? I said, I don't know. He said, well, that's good. Just have a seat. Meeting be starting a little while. Well, about a week, 2 weeks into that, you know, have had a drink. None of this shit makes any sense. People are talking about weird stuff. I'm nothing like you people. I've not reached that level. Y'all have no clue. I ain't heard the first damn person talk about anything that is like me. You know, don't look for the differences. Find the common. Yeah, I'm not finding it, you know. So anyway, that same old man, he asked me one day, he said, hey, so does any of this make any sense to you? I said, no, not a bit. He said, well, that's great. You're right where you need to be. And I'm like, what the hell, old man? You know, you're getting up on my list of people that are going to get slapped here soon. And time goes on and I'm sitting there, I'm not sociable, I'm not damn willing to talk to people. I still have a high and tight, meaning zero on the sides, half inch on top. I look angry at the world, which I was angry at the world, very unapproachable. But I do remember that first night that I was there. At the Gwinnett room, you had two meeting rooms. All the readings were over here in this room, the non-smoking side, and they break after the readings, and you had a smoking meeting and a non-smoking meeting. Well, on my way to the smoking meeting, this beautiful little blonde-headed chick jumps up, asks who I am, why I'm there, blah, blah, blah. And I'm there with my, quote, girlfriend. It's 13 years my senior. And I'm like, well, I'm here with her. And she's like, well, who's this, your sister? I said, no, nah, you know, we go through the whole story. You know, it's my girlfriend. She's kind of taken back because, I don't know, for some reason, damn, older women chase me. But anyway, very interesting that, you know, I met this one blonde-headed chick. Don't know who she is or anything about her, but, you know, she had that bubbly personality that, you know, gets your attention. So anyway, story goes on. I'm trying to get sober, or I'm not drinking and coming back tomorrow. And I do that for, I don't know, about 9 months. And in that 9 months, none of this is making any sense. There's no common ground. I'm not hearing anybody telling my story. I hear people ask questions. I'm like, oh, shit. I was just wondering that the other day. And then the old-timer rips their ass about, you know, how wrong they are for asking that question. They know more about drinking. They don't know anything about recovery and this and that. And we had some hard-hitting old-timers up there at the Gwinnett room. And it just, you know, reminded me I didn't need to speak in a meeting because we'd probably be dusting it up in the parking lot afterwards because, you know, I don't do well with, you know, being chastised in front of a crowd like that. It's like, oh, you got a problem. Come on, man. Let's go out there. We're going to talk about this. But anyway, time goes on. 9 months. Haven't had a drink. I'm at the jumping off point. Either I'm going to drink, I'm going to kill somebody, I'm going to kill myself. Something's got to change because I have all these things that they call emotions and feelings. You know, I don't have alcohol to numb anything. And all this shit from teenage years to being 34, everything just damn snowballing, hitting me at one time, and I had no clue how to deal with any of it. So I talked to a guy, had become friends with this guy, and told him what was going on. I said, I need some help. I said, I don't know what to do. Will you help me with this? And he started laughing, and then he leaned over and started talking to his buddy next to him, told him what I'd said, and he started laughing, and I'm like, God, no money. And they get done laughing. They said, yeah, we're going to help you through it. Don't worry about it. We'll get you there. And I found a sponsor, or I'm going to actually say a sponsor found me. I was sitting there one night. I belong to another fellowship that's more about fun and helping the community. But I was wearing a jacket from a circus we had, and the old man that greeted me and whatnot, there was another old man that sat right next to him. They both had strokes. One's affected right side, one's affected left side. They share an ashtray in the smoking room. So we call them the king and queen of the smoking room in the Gwinnett room. Well, anyway, this old man recognizes my jacket, speaks to me, find out that that me and him are in the same fellowship. And I knew that was the one man in 500 people. That was the only man I knew I could trust in that room. And asked him to be my sponsor. And he was not real pleasant about it, and he wasn't real happy that I'd chosen him. But he also had a bigger obligation than AA that he's supposed to, you know, we're supposed to help fellow brothers out. And he's like, yeah, I'll help you. So this cantankerous, mean, ornery old man takes on this damn sponsee, and we start going through the steps. Step one, yeah, powers over alcohol, no problem. My life unmanageable, I don't get how my life's unmanageable. I have a company, we're successful, I have a house, I have kids, I had a wife, but, you know, I had the American dream, so how's my life unsuccessful? He said, well, let's not concentrate on that, let's just get on through these steps, you know, we'll pick up more later. So We go through the steps. Things are really, really interesting. I'm getting sober. Year comes up. Have to go pick up a chick. They force me to do it. You know, I don't want to step up in front of the room, in front of the crowd, in front of all these people. All damn bundle of nerves. I don't know how to damn act. I don't know how to deal with feelings. But, yeah, I have to walk up here and accept a one-year chip. Sponsor gives me my chip. Great and everything. Go on about it. People warn you, you know, don't go celebrate on your first year. You know, don't go out that night celebrating because you did it. About 16 months, I think, we wound up starting a new group up in Lawrenceville. And I was part of that. Got involved with fixing the building, cleaning it up, doing everything we had to do to have a clubhouse. And not once did I ever raise my hand and say, hey, I would like to do some service work. What can I do to be of service? I just happened to see something that needed to be done, picked up the tools, started doing it, and come to find out that was called service work. Most of my sobriety of the shit I have gotten into has been my higher power doing for me what I cannot do for myself. 18 months, I became suicidal. Don't know why, don't know the reason, but anyway, I knew I needed to go check myself in and address this issue, and I wind up going to GRN, and y'all are going to love this one. I get out of GRN, you know, 72-hour hold, whatever it was, talk to the doctor, get put on Prozac for depression, walk out of the facility, get my phone back. As soon as I turn my phone on, damn thing starts ringing. And it's this good-looking blonde chick from the Gwinnett Room asking me to tell my story. I'm like, no, I can't do that. I've only got 18 months. It's a bad idea. You know, I'm not in a good place. Oh, no, that's all the more reason. Anyway, argued for about damn 15 minutes of why I cannot tell my story. I just got out of the loony bin, for God's sakes. What's encouraging about that? Oh, that's all the more reason for you to do it. Now, I will say, if it had been a fat, ugly woman calling me to ask me to tell my story, I would not have told my story. But it's that same blonde-headed girl that I met day one. She is my guardian angel. That's what I refer to her as. She has, she's been part of my recovery since I got there. She's gone back out a couple of times. Her story, it's a sad and it's an amazing one. Right now, she's not in the rooms with us. She was very instrumental in just being a friend, you know, and for the life of me, I don't know why, you know. She just always, you know, hey, come sit up here at the table with me. You know, don't sit at that damn table. That's where people share from, you know, what the hell? And she's like, well, share something. Tell people where you are, you know, how you feel. Where? I don't have anything to share. Well, then speak up and say that. You don't have anything to share. It's very instrumental, you know, of being there to push me into doing things. And the funny thing is, there again, that's God doing for me what I could not do for myself. I firmly believe that young lady was put there. She was put there for the reason of pushing me in a direction I needed to go for no other reason than, you know, the higher power. My understanding likes to do damn silly shit and make me look back and realize what's going on. But anyway, get out and I tell my story that night at 18 months. And I ended my story with, and 4 hours ago, I walked out of GRN for depression, suicidal thinking. I said, that's my story. You know, everybody applauded, stood up. Well, it was an amazing thing happened because about 12 to 15 people in that room came up after I was done to tell me that they too were there at 12 months, 14 months, 20 months, whatever. You know, they had been down that road fighting depression, going and getting help along with alcoholism. And I was like, wow, holy shit. And that was the first time I really felt connected to this program, that I was not alone, that I was not by myself, that other people have been there and done that. Time went on. That was 18 months. I don't know. I guess somewhere around 20, 22 months. I went to my sponsor, and you really got a picture of this old guy. You know, you could almost use Frank as an example. You go to this man, and he has infinite wisdom. But, you know, you may not be intimidated by approaching him to get that wisdom. So I asked my sponsor, he's like, well, damn, Ron. I said, yo, I've been here. I haven't had a drink. When's this miraculous shit going to happen? You know, when is something going to happen? He said, yeah, I know what you mean. He said, when do you get a year? I said, I've got a year, Ron. You gave me my chip. He's like, oh, yeah, that's right. That was a few months back, wasn't it? I said, yeah. He's like, wow, an alcoholic like you didn't take a drink for 365 days in a row. And that's not miraculous for you? And I'm like, oh. Yeah. Yeah, let me ponder on that for a minute. So, you know, this sponsor, I love them dead. You know, he's gone now, but he was great. He was exactly what I needed when I needed it. And, you know, like I say, I firmly believe there's certain things along our path that are done that we can't control that I'm sorry, but, you know, I have to admit somebody's putting these plays into action for me. And I got out of Nut House, asked about the miraculous thing. Well, all kinds of miraculous things happened along this journey. It was probably somewhere, you know, I'm not good with timelines anymore. My parents always told me, you know, once I got to a certain age, life would just zip by. Well, it's happening to me because you can ask me when something happened. I'll tell you it was a year ago, 2 years ago. It may be 10 years ago. I don't know. Somewhere around 24 months, 26 months, I don't know. What I do know is my son was in second grade. We were having problems. He was calling me at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, begging me to please come get him from his mom and bring him home with me. And I couldn't understand what was going on. My ex-wife just started a new relationship. So, of course, my mind's questioning the integrity of this guy. Do I need to go kill somebody? Did I get sober for nothing so I can go kill people again? What the hell? This ain't working out. So I talked my ex-wife and take him to the psychiatrist, child psychiatrist, find out what the hell's going on because he doesn't want to go to school. He's crying at 4 in the morning for me to come get him in secrecy. You know, please come get me. Please come get me. Tearing me apart. I'm trying to get sober. Bottom line is that he wanted to be with his dad. Wow, you know, what the hell? You know, I expected my daughter, when she was of age, to make the decision daddy's little girl was going to be moving in with daddy. You know, that's kind of a given. My ex-wife knew it. I knew it. You know, everybody knew that. Well, for some reason, my son wanted to be with me and talked to my ex-wife about it, and he moved in with me on a trial basis of how he did in school and how things went and whatnot. And the boy excelled, you know, A and B student on the damn dean's list all the time or whatever the hell you call the high society of high school. I was never on it, so I don't know the name for it, but great kid, you know, and it's funny because that little boy saved my life by moving in with me. And I say that because now I had to eat. Because, I mean, I would go days without eating, not realizing I hadn't ate. Yeah, well, you know, kids are funny. They want all three meals. And they want it to be of substance. You know, a Twinkie and a cup of coffee does not make for a full day's meal. You know, I had to grow up and do some adult things and deal with schools and teachers. And, you know, as he got in high school and started, quote, coming into his own, a couple of his teachers weren't quite ready to deal with his father, being a self-assured, recovering alcoholic that's comfortable in his own skin, that I tend to say what I think. You know, and it's rather interesting. But as the journey went on in recovery, there was one instance that I remember. I knew was not me. My son was at his mother's and had relit a barbecue grill for mom's boyfriend. Excuse me. And as a propane-assisted thing, they'd taken the safety off of it. And pilot light went out. Well, my son being the good kid he is, you know, so it doesn't, the meat doesn't get ruined where, he's going to relight this grill. He takes a lighter, reaches in the grill, light, damn thing explodes in his face. Wound up second, third degree burns on his hands, lost an eyebrow, you know, quote, his nice little hair on top of his head. But anyway, I get the phone call that, you know, there's been an emergency. They're going to the ER. I get up to the ER, go in, son sitting there scared to death. Look at him. I see his hair singed and his hands in a pitcher of ice water. I pull it out and look at it, and, you know, skin's all nice and white. I don't know if y'all have ever seen real burns, but it was ugly sight to behold, but it was only on his hand. You know, his face just had, you know, minor first, second degree burns on it, you know. I was like, thank God this is no worse than it is. I'm so happy for that. My ex-wife fell apart. She started crying, bawling, whatever, and her sister-in-law comforted her. And I'm like, what's her problem? And she's like, well, you didn't react the way she thought you were going to. Meaning that when I watch kids, I watch kids. I mean, literally, it's not going to happen on my watch. They may break an arm doing stupid things, but they're not going to be out of my sight that I'm accountable, you know, because they're kids. So normally it is, well, how did this happen? What do you mean you were watching? If you were watching him, how the hell did he get out there to light a damn, you know, come on, really? So, you know, it was my way or the highway. You know, I wanted 100% accountability, but that day I just gratefully wasn't hurt. And I walk out of that hospital. I was like, who in the hell was that in there? Because that was not Stephen. You know, you're talking about my baby boy, my son. I kill people for that. You know, you do my son wrong, I had no problem going to prison. It was like, wow, I am changing. This program is working. So as time wore on, you know, I could count over countless things, but I had a relationship that I was in for, I guess, 11 years in recovery. And the poor girl, she was bipolar, and she wound up hurting her knee, going to the doctor, got pain pills. Pain pills turned in about 4 different doctors. You know, now her back hurt, her knee hurt, her tooth hurt, this hurt, that hurt. Me being naive, I didn't really see all the signs of it. Finally got to a point where, you know, passing out in the middle of the AA meeting because you're too messed up on goofballs, as I like to call them. I realized, you know, things had to change. Time for you to go. And that was a tough thing to deal with in sobriety. You know, they say we quit growing when we start, quote, drinking or drugging or whatever your choice is. You know, we quit growing at that point when we start using it as an excuse not to feel things. And I laugh about it because I'm sitting there and I'm realizing that I am dealing with a breakup, so to speak, of doing what's right. And I should have no problem doing what's right. What's best for my son, what's best for me, where shouldn't be a problem. But then I have all these damn weird feelings to go with it. I'm like, you know, this is that shit I should have been dealing with in high school when I should have had a girlfriend instead of having a Bud Light tall as my best friend. What the hell? So it was interesting that I saw all these things in my recovery. Well, after her, didn't date for, I don't know, probably over a year and a half. Started dating again. And let me tell you, I forget Frank's exact quote on it. Maybe he'll give it to us when I botch it up. But AA is not the health bed of...
it's not necessarily a hotbed of mental health.
There you go. There you go. I will testify that he is correct. A really good one that y'all will enjoy is that there was one young lady that decided I need to change my careers because I was not living to my fullest potential financially. So I was like, well, can we look at some numbers of what I need to be making in order to afford the apartment, whatever, if we're going to move in together, this, that, the other. She's like, no, you just need to quit the job you're at and get something else and make more money. I'm like, well, I kind of need to know what price range I'm looking for money in. you just need to leave that job. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I think this one needs to be going on down the road. Let me figure out how to dispose of this. And in the meantime, I'm trying to figure this out. And it was right there at Christmas time, and she'd been hounding, engagement ring. Well, she didn't get an engagement ring for Christmas. Needless to say, I didn't hear from her after Christmas until January 3rd or 4th. I bumped into her at a meeting. And I found it really ironic, but she more or less just decided she was done. She didn't get what she wanted and done with it. And I was upset. And I laugh about that because I was upset that I got what I wanted, but it wasn't on my damn terms. So there again, I quit growing and, I'm having to learn how to deal with that. I moved forward and, a lot of great things happened over the years. 10-year mark, I bought me a Harley Davidson, started riding again. I gave up motorcycle riding back, in my teens because I knew two wheels and alcohol don't mix. That's how you wind up dead, and I really didn't quite want to die. But bought me a Harley Davidson, started riding again, having a lot of fun, met this girl up at the Biscayne Room, convinced her to go riding. Yeah, well, she met my family and kind of scared her. So that kind of went south. But they would say life went off. A couple years later, that same poor girl conned her into going on a ride again. And 15 hours later, she's lecturing me about how I need to get a new motorcycle because the seat's really uncomfortable on that one. You can talk to her after the meeting to get her side of the story, but the truth. Anyway, that's good enough reason to buy a new motorcycle, make the little princess happy riding on the big couch on the back. But went on. We wound up getting married during COVID, right before COVID. Had a big wedding plan, big extravaganza. COVID came. Everybody started canceling left and right. She had a nuclear meltdown. Her wedding was destroyed, ruined, blah, blah, blah. And I suggested, hey, why don't we just go ahead and get married? That's the date you want to get married on. We can go ahead and get married. Your dad's going to officiate. All we need is somewhere for you, me, him, and a couple of witnesses to show up. We wound up getting married in the Biscayne Room on April the 4th, 2020. Look at that, I even remember. And the funny thing is, all that hoopla, she was having a meltdown. I said, well, we'll just get married, caterer. Everything's paid for, everything's lined up, and COVID hits, so all bets are off now. So I said, well, we'll just have a party, in a year, whatever. When all this mess is over, you can have the big extravagant, wear your dress, all that fun shit. Anyway, so we got married twice. So now, in my sobriety, I have to admit that I married the same woman twice, sober. I never really thought about that until me and some of my buddies were making fun of one another who'd been married the most. It kind of dawned on me, wait a minute, I married the same woman twice. What the heck? Damn, that doesn't look good. But anyway, married, happy. Today I live a life that I love. I mean, I truly enjoy getting up and living life and living it on life's terms. Things come and go, people come and go. Disappointment. People pass away. There's a lot of things you can deal with in this program. You know, and one of my favorite things that I have seen is that no matter what your problem is, if you will speak up, key word, if you will speak up and ask somebody for help, there is somebody in these rooms that has been through what you're fixing to go through. I have yet to see that problem that nobody in the room has been through. You know, you may not like the person. You may not want to have to go ask that person how they got through it. But there is somebody in all these rooms that has been through it, that has been there, and has not picked up a drink. The other thing I'll say is that I'm a big advocate of what you say. You have no idea the power of the words that you talk when you speak to the newcomers, when you speak to people. When you speak and you don't even know who you're talking to. I had an instance one time at trade school. A guy came up to me, asked me if I was buddies with Bill. Well, of course, me being me, I'm like, Bill who? You know, I know about eight Bills. I'm trying to figure out where I know this guy from through Bill who. He's like, no, program. I said, oh, yeah. Evidently, I said something profound that changed his whole course of his sobriety. And he accredits it to me. At the Clarkston group. I was going to the Clarkston group in my first year of recovery. God only knows what I said. I have no idea. I asked the kid what it was that I said. He had no idea, but he remembered it was me and that it changed his course of the program. And that wasn't me. That was God using me. So you never know, you know, who's listening, so to speak. People watch you. You know, I watch people in these rooms all the time. You know, it's amazing the level of recovery that happens. You know, my recovery, everybody that I learned crap from in early recovery, I would say are dead or back out there. Because when I go back to the Gwinnett room, out of, I don't know, 300 people that were there when I got there, there's about 7 people left that, you know, I regularly... You know, recognize and whatever. I can ask, hey, what happened to so-and-so? What happened to so-and-so? Nobody knows. You know, I hope they found a different meaning, moved on with life, moved across the country. I don't know. But, you know, people come and go in this program. But my constant is that I know no matter what happens, if I don't drink and I come back tomorrow, I stand a chance of staying sober. I still go to meetings. You know, it's almost been 20 years. I still go to meetings. I still talk to my sponsor. I still have damn pigeons that won't call me. You know, it's an amazing journey. But I keep coming to meetings because I have to be reminded of what it is that I am not doing in the program. I wish I could tell you, oh, I got this thing down. I know the big book like the back of my hand. I couldn't quote you. The only thing I can quote you out of the big book is page 69 and page 96. If you will read the passages from those two pages, you can twist it up and it's funny as hell. But that's the only great quote I have out of the big book, you know. But I have to come back to be reminded of what it is I'm not doing, because it's funny that I can go to meetings, I can come here to NAVA, I can go to Biscayne, my home group. I go to Gwinnett room, and the meeting topic will be, oh, wow, you know, maybe I ought to look at that. Oh, come to think of it, I haven't been praying here lately, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's where I get the answers to the problems that I deal with. I come to meetings. I share where I'm at. I have bitched about it before that I'm tired of having life experiences in order to share my experience, strength, and hope. Meaning sometimes I just have bad weeks and, you know, everything just kind of seems to keep piling on. And it's like, man, why do I have to have all these experiences to share this with others? Why do I have to be the guy? When I'm not the guy going through the suffering, it's always a great thing to be on the peace and serenity side of it. But the best thing is I have not had to pick up a drink to deal with any of it. So, with that, I'll shut up and give you your meeting back.
Suffrey, thank you so much for your services and your story. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
if the river keep a rising. Water gonna overflow. If that river keep a rising, flood water gonna overflow. Just like that old river, baby, it's my time to go.